is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
So, Simon Foster, people who listen to this podcast on a regular probably don't quite realize that there is a video version of this podcast. It's not some sort of weird running joke where we talk about the video version. There's actually a video version. People can get on the YouTube. They can watch the program there. If they listen to us via Spotify, like look at the app every so often, you'll be able to see video of us streaming through there.
It's worth it too, because as we point out in the podcast description, we are quite handsome for people with our personal habits. So it's important that do check us out sometimes. We thought this might lead to some kind of television gig when we started this podcast, and that was soon laughed out of the industry. So
I'm not sure there was ever a danger of that, but certainly there is a video version. When you watch the video version, it's not just a theme song that you hear. There's opening titles. There is a video component to that. When you hear the trailers, you can watch the video of the trailers. It's very exciting.
You've done a good job with those,
and
I know.
Also, on very special days like this, you can see a number of things happening in there. Because on the podcast this week, we are going to talk about the new Ninja Turtles movie. It's called Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem. We're going to talk about Blue Beetle. We're going to talk about The Lovers. We're going to talk about A Haunting in Venice. But we're also going to spend a few minutes talking back about a TV show called The X-Files. It celebrated its 30th anniversary of the first episode over the weekend. So we're going to have a bit of a X-Files retrospective conversation. And to support that, people can look at the t-shirt Simon's wearing on that video podcast, and they can see Dana Scully, Fox Mulder on the t-shirt.
Yeah, it doesn't fit me as much as it did once. I think either the t-shirt shrunk, or let's just say the t-shirt shrunk.
Yeah, the t-shirt's changed.
Definitely t-shirt shrunk. But yeah, you see this t-shirt popping up everywhere. It became kind of a thing over the last couple of years. I interviewed a filmmaker once, can't remember who it was, and I was wearing this, and he ran to his cupboard and got out his version of this t-shirt as well. So it was a kind of a big thing, which was nice. Yeah, I'm very excited to talk about the X-Files. Hello, screen watchers. Hope you're all well. Hey.
Sorry, the filmmaker, was Martin Scorsese?
No, he only wears his own merch. That's the whole Scorsese thing.
Yeah. Also on the video podcast, sorry, Simon, I was getting somewhere with it. They can look at my novelty t-shirt where I've got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles happening there.
Oh, my God. We're adults, you know. Hey, that looks really cool. Is that a new one? Did you rush out and buy that at EB Games or Zoom store?
So it's new to me. I've never worn this t-shirt outside of about 3 minutes ago. I put this t-shirt on, but it was actually given to me by the team at Nickelodeon back in 2016-ish.
Really? You're still getting into seven-year-old t-shirts? Serious?
Yeah, I was in a plastic bag. I just took it out of the plastic bag and put it on.
Wow.
I was saving this one for a special occasion.
Oh, but we went with this podcast instead, which is nice.
Exactly. And also, if you're on a video podcast behind me, you can see a VHS poster of the movie Judgment Night, a movie which did never actually existed, but there was an amazing soundtrack released for it.
Yes. Tell you a very quick funny story. We had a bit of a talk prior to the podcast about Judgment Night. I once had an open fireplace, or not an open fireplace, but one of those potbelly fireplaces, which were very popular back in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And I took the VHS of Judgment Night, the VHS tape, out of the recorder, placed it on top of the said potbelly oven, potbelly fire, only to wake up in the morning to find that it had melted right through the grate and had completely destroyed the said Judgment Night tape, which in light of what we're discussing, how it's hard to find now, seems particularly wasteful.
Yeah, look, I was just thinking that could be worth like millions now. You could have retired off the sale of that Judgment Night VHS. Although I am on eBay right now, and apparently you can buy it for $13.69.
Yeah. I had more fun burning it, actually, quite frankly. But, well, it happened. I could have burnt the house down. That was very dangerous.
Well, actually, Simon, if it was an Australian copy, it was probably a PAL version, and you can get a PAL VHS for $7.76.
Seems reasonable. I'd invest in that.
Good price.
We had a fun morning this morning. We discovered that Donald Glover and Stephen Glover's Lando is going to be a movie and not a Disney Plus series. Now, I read through the Variety report and I didn't state whether it was going to be a big screen movie, like a cinema version, or if it was going to go to the Disney Plus channel. It's going to the big screen, is it? Well, that's interesting. Donald Glover was one of the things about Star Wars.
Simon, you're jumping the gun a little bit. How many Star Wars projects from the last, I don't know, we'll say 4 years, have they announced for the big screen that are actually ever going to be made? Expect this one to be a media release alone, and we'll see if anything ever comes of it.
That's interesting. I can always rely on you for your cynical appraisal of what might be a big deal in the world of Star Wars. But
I felt conflicted with the story, Simon, because the whole thing is that this Lando project, it was a spin-off from the Solo movie, taking Donald Glover's interpretation of a younger Lando Calrissian and taking him into his own TV series. Now, I thought perfectly fine. That's kind of what these Disney Plus stories should be. They should be the lower tier characters and explore the unusual pockets of the Star Wars universe. But when it comes to the big screen films, like, they should be sort of big spectacles and what you kind of expect from the big screen with Star Wars.
Sure.
So that's all cool. But one of the frustrations, and I say this almost weekly on the podcast, is did this need to be a 6-episode TV series? Isn't it really just a 100-minute movie that's been stretched out? And so I feel conflicted because, yes, Lando could just be a 100-minute movie, but also this movie's going to tank terribly. If it ever gets made, which I don't think it will, okay, first of all, it's a spin-off from the least financially successful movie that a Star Wars title's ever offered on the big screen.
Yes. Okay?
So that's a concern. Critically, not particularly well received, middling audience reaction to it. The fans really loved the last 10 minutes of it, but the rest of the film divides.
Which was all reshoots done by Ron Howard. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think there's really demand for a Lando movie. I think there's demand for Star Wars that feels new and fresh, and anything that comes out of it feeling like it's a bit new and fresh generally tends to get well received. But yeah, Lando, I don't know. Simon.
Dan Barrett taking on the Star Wars fandom. Good for you, Dan. There's also a trailer that dropped this morning for the new Frasier, which I know you are a mega fan of. Now, I haven't watched the trailer as yet. It was in your screen. What is it called? Always Be Streaming, Always Be Watching newsletter. Is it worth your time and effort to have a look at this trailer? What were your initial thoughts?
So you say big fan. I should probably establish I'm a very big fan of the 80s sitcom Cheers.
Yes.
Okay, 11 seasons of greatness for the most part. Great sitcom. That's where the Frasier character began. His spin-off series, I kind of don't mind at the beginning, but very quickly that show lost me. I just wasn't really into it.
All right.
And comedically, it works at a different rhythm than Cheers does. Cheers was a hangout workplace comedy. Frasier was very much a family-based show, but the comedy was rooted very heavily in a lot of slapstick and a lot of, you know, closing door sort of comedy.
There was a lot of very sort of slick wordplay, certainly those first couple of years as well. It was a very well-written sitcom. There's no denying that.
Yeah, I mean, it's well-written. It just wasn't really quite to my taste. It seems going by the trailer, the flavor of this feels so much more in terms of the rhythms of Cheers than it did the Frasier show. So it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is to that show when it drops.
Nice one. All right. A couple of quick plugs for our social pages. Over on our Facebook page, you can win tickets to see Saw 10. God knows we need another Saw movie. The last Saw movie you and I went and saw.
That was from the Book of Saw. I still don't know what a Book of Saw is, but here we are.
Well, it led to Saw 10. We're giving away double passes on our Facebook page. And you can check out on our YouTube channel an interview that I did with Johan Gabrielsson. If you don't know him, you should know his film. It's called Climate Changes. It's a profile of Professor Tim Flannery and where we are in the world of climate debate and hot house dramas. It's over on our YouTube channel. There are the dogs of fate barking at us right now that are leading us down the path towards annihilation in the world of global warming. Or was that your dog? I can't be sure.
That was my dog in the background. Now, Simon, before we throw to reviews, if people haven't checked out the Saw promotional video that dropped during the week, which was a parody of Nicole Kidman sitting in the AMC theaters talking about how great the cinema experience is, do yourself a favor. That was pretty special.
That was very funny. Very funny. Do check it out. Good. Let's get on with the show.
It stinks.
I guess, Simon, we probably need to begin with the most important cultural event of 2023. It is the brand new Ninja Turtles movie. It's called Mutant Mayhem.
Boys, where have you been? We're just running errands.
That's it?
Look, we're really sorry, Splinter. Some of the guys wanted to get pizza, and I tried to talk them out of it.
Leo!
You ratted us out.
Hey, don't use that word that way.
I mean, it's 2023.
Sorry, Dad.
I've talked about the Ninja Turtles a number of times in this podcast. It was a... I guess the way to maybe contextualize it, which is, why is Dan so excited about the Ninja Turtles? Realize that when the Turtles first really became a thing in Australia, we're talking about 1989. It's only debuted in 87 in the US, but we started getting around 89. And in 1989, I was 9 years old. So why is Dan so interested in the Ninja Turtles? It's because it came here when I was 9 years old. Simon, there is no more culturally important thing in my world than the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So
we get it. We know. We got it.
And they've been part of my life for the entirety of me having a life. So, or not having a life, depending on how you want to phrase these things.
I think we've established that already.
As a child, I watched the cartoon. 9 years old, I'm watching the cartoon. 1990, a live action movie comes out, Simon. Obviously, my mind was blown because that year was like 15 years of kid year. Like, you know, I'd lived like an eternity with the Turtles at that point. So to get a live action movie.
Dreams. I know.
I mean, keep in mind, same director.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, from Steve the director of Electric Dreams. I know. Terrific filmmaker.
Sorry, I only just heard Electric Dreams and didn't hear the rest of what you were saying. So we've got the Turtles film that came out. I was 10 years old. That was a huge moment in my life. Over the next couple of years, they released sequels. Number 2 came out, and then there was that third one, Turtles in Time. No, that was the name of the video game. I don't know. They went back in time to feudal Japan. I never saw that one, Simon. I've never seen that Turtles film. Like, that back there, traveling in time, I haven't got a clue what happened beyond the fact they traveled in time. They may not even have traveled in time. They could have gone to a theme restaurant. I don't know for sure, but there's definitely that third film I never saw. They did the revival live-action TV series where they introduced the live-action female turtle into it.
They did?
Yeah.
I don't remember any of this. This is all past me. I was an adult by this stage.
I mean, I was an adult at this stage as well. But, you know, I'm aware of it. So, look, they had the live-action TV show. This series was called The Next Mutation, if my memory serves. There was another animated series shortly afterwards. There was the live-action Michael Bay-produced movies from the mid-2010s. And the thing to know about those mid-2010s and the couple of animated shows that came out in the mid-2010s is there was a change of ownership of the Ninja Turtles. It stopped being owned by the guys at Mirage Studios, which was owned by Peter Laird and Kevin Eastman, creators of the Turtles. And instead, Nickelodeon, the people at Paramount Global, now own the Ninja Turtles. So for the last 13-ish years now, we've seen a massive rise in the number of Turtle productions around the place. There were those live-action movies. There were, I think, 2 to 3 different versions of animated shows running during that time as well. And now we're leading to another animated movie. So it's very much Paramount are out there, Paramount Global, Nickelodeon, are out there to exploit the Ninja Turtles in whatever way they can. So the question is, you think, well, they've kind of been exploiting the Ninja Turtles, and we saw those live-action movies. Paramount have proven themselves to be good stewards of the Turtles franchise by the animated shows from the last 15 years, but there were those live-action films, and they were pretty awful, okay? Can we necessarily trust them to deliver some Turtle goodness? They've got this new animated film. They've taken their inspiration very much from the Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse films with some very interesting animation styles. And I've got to say, this might be the best Ninja Turtles feature film so far to date.
Wow, what a huge call.
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, exactly.
My throat. That's a big call. And the support backs it up. I think it's running at like 80% on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's got the fanboy reviewer base revved up. Do go on.
Yeah, look, this is just a lot of fun. My wife was considering the idea of coming along to see it, but she had other work to do that night, so I gave it a bit of a miss. And I thought, bullet dodge, she would have hated this. But then I was watching the movie and I thought, you know what? She actually probably would have enjoyed this. I think this is a broadly accessible, fairly fun animated film. And I was certainly a bit concerned for myself, as is usually my biggest concern, just around the idea of sitting in the cinema and getting a few minutes thinking, maybe I'm too old for the Ninja Turtles, but apparently I'm not, because boy, did this film deliver. First of all, animation style, let's talk about that. The visual style for it is based on the idea that if you're a 14-year-old kid who's like doodling away in a back of a like book or something while you're in class, well, that's the idea, Simon. Yeah. So
there's huge chunks of this which feel like a high school diary doodle thing, which is great, like but taken to the big screen degree. And it, I thought that was a terrific idea.
Yeah, and so that's very much the intention here. And so you're watching this and everything looks a bit weird and strange. The turtles don't look like the sort of strong, muscular turtles that we've seen in a lot of other productions from years gone by. Instead, they kind of look like sort of weedy, uncomfortable-looking, gawky-looking teenagers, but turtle people. That's kind of fun. April O'Neil is a character in this who we've seen in many incarnations of the turtle, being their human friend. She's stopped being the glamorous, very tall, red-haired journalist running around in the yellow...
Megan Fox in the last film, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Instead, here, she's a fairly sort of squat, rotund, African-American teenage girl who is just struggling with being accepted by her peers and doesn't have a huge friendship group. She's got the emotional sort of fallout from being caught on the high school... we don't really do this in Australia, but you find in some high schools, I guess, in the US, where they've got like their own, like, you know, the school newspaper type thing. Yes. But they've got a video, like a TV production thing where once a day, like some enterprising students will read like the news of the day and it'll be like a package.
The AV club.
Yeah. Like the AV club. So some schools in the US do this as a video thing. So it's not like a confection for the cartoon, but she's doing one of these and vomited on camera because she was so nervous. And so part of the story here is her redemption, trying to find a way back into journalism and to try to get the respect of her peers once more. And she comes across these turtles. The turtles are struggling with the fact that they are gawky teenagers who just want to do teenage stuff. They want to get out there and enjoy the world. They've got a father figure in the form of Splinter, the mutated rat that we've seen in other incarnations of the turtles over the years as well.
Uh-oh. I did a review the other day and I called him Shredder. That's going to get back, isn't it?
Yeah, dude. His name is Splinter. Shredder. We'll get to Shredder. Okay. But Splinter's told them for all their lives, don't go outside. The humans are going to attack you. They're probably going to milk you. And, you know, you think that they're not going to get milked. But at some point in this movie, the turtles get milked.
Milking turtles. There you go, kids. That's entertainment in the year 2023.
Very much so. So that being told, don't go out into the public. You don't want to be involved in humans, like the human world. It's not for you. They're just going to turn on you. And so a lot of this is very much that quest of theirs to find a connection to the outside world that they hunger for so heavily and find this human connection in the form of April. How does that impact them and how do they find the acceptance they're looking for in the world? There's a great sequence where they go and sit on a rooftop and watch a movie being played in the park. I'm not going to reveal what that movie is, but it absolutely sets the tone for the rest of this film. Hmm. It's fantastic. Anyway, this film, it's a delight, Simon. Voice cast on it, the turtles are voiced by actual teenagers. Micah Abbey, Shaman Brown Jr., Nicholas Cantu, Brady Noon. Nobody's ever heard of these people before because they're teenagers and this is their breakout. But their voice work is really, really good. It's strong. They feel authentically like teenagers because they are.
Very distinctive, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, April O'Neil. They were great. They were all good together.
April O'Neil, voiced by an adult, but it's Ayo Edebiri, who we talk about on this podcast every week. Simon, is your weekly check-in. Have you watched The Bear yet?
No, but we have made a household decision that we are going to watch The Bear this weekend. We're going to leap into it because she is apparently front and center of this, and I'm a big fan of her, big fan of Molly Gordon. What's the guy's name? Jeremy White? Jeremy something. Yeah. We're on board. We're going to do it. Stop sending me the texts, okay? I don't want to be woken up again at 2 a.m. by one of your stupid bear texts. But, you know, we will watch it, I promise.
It's coming. Other voices that you'll find in here, so actual names. I mean, not that Ayo Edebiri isn't a big name at this point. She's, you know, starting to get the traction. Maya Rudolph's in there, John Cena, Seth Rogen, Rose Byrne. A hilarious Rose Byrne playing the character Leatherhead, who's a giant mutated crocodile.
With a real Aussie accent. Very un-Rose Byrne-like.
I read a quote of hers a few months ago where she was talking about it, and Seth Rogen, who was one of the co-writers and producer of the movie, just told her, go full Aussie, and she absolutely goes full Aussie on it.
She's very funny in it. And Jackie Chan, of course, doing Shredder / Splinter. He's terrific.
Well, I can confirm he plays Splinter and not Shredder, who does make an appearance in the movie, but I'm not going to talk about the closing credit sequence.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Look, I'm all on board as well. I really like the film.
A couple of other big names. Giancarlo Esposito is in there. Ice Cube plays the main bad guy in it. Post Malone, Hannibal Buress, and as the closing credits reveal, introducing Paul Rudd as Mondo Gecko. Yeah, I thought the introducing tag was funny.
That is funny. Seth Rogen has brought in all the turtle fellow turtle fans that he could find and made a terrific voice cast, none of which seem like stunt casting. These are all sort of people who work really well in the parts. Yeah, look, I'm not the big turtle head that you are, and I must admit this was sort of just ticking the boxes when it came to the week's reviews I had to do for some other networks and I handed it over to you for this podcast. But having watched it, I had a ball, and I think you're right. I think it is probably the smartest, most fully realized version of the turtles that we've seen. Whether that comes because there's so much backstory that we already know about them and it can play on that, or whether it is this new energized animation style that gives it oomph, that could be debated. But either way you look at it, it works a treat.
Well, I don't think it really plays on the backstory that much. Like, I think that young kids can come into this with no knowledge at all of the Ninja Turtles. And there's very few in-jokes. The closest that ever gets to an in-joke is at no point in a film do they ever actually call them the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but they do refer to them as Hero Turtles at one point, which is a very sort of niche joke about the fact that in the UK they weren't called Ninja Turtles, they're called Hero Turtles. Mm. Okay, but that's as deep as like the in-jokes get. Like, outside of that, it could be a brand new franchise and people are none the poorer for it.
All good. Yep, I'm on board. I'm happy with it. Rogan's done a good job and he should be commended. And it's done pretty well at the US box office. I don't know how it's going to travel internationally with the fan base is huge for around the world.
I think you'll find the Turtles were a global phenomenon. Like, broadly, they were...
A global phenomenon?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's going to play perfectly well globally. What's interesting about this is apparently there's already a sequel that's greenlit for it, which is good news because I'm very keen to see more of the Mutant Mayhem team. But they've actually got an animated series which is going to connect the two movies. So if you can't wait for that new film to come out, there's going to be a cartoon show over the next year using the characters from this version of the Turtles and leading into the next film.
Via where will that play? Is that a Paramount Plus property now, or will it go to Nickelodeon?
Oh, well, I mean, Nickelodeon stuff's on Paramount Plus, so...
Yeah, but will it play the Nickelodeon channel, or will it...
Yeah, but nobody cares about the... Like, who's watching the Nickelodeon broadcast channel anymore? Not the kids, Simon.
Do they still do Nick at Night? I used to love Nick at Night. You could watch Gomer Pyle. You could see Sergeant Bilko. Remember Sergeant Bilko? Anyway, we're getting off topic here.
Good grief. Anyway, playing in cinemas now, give it a look. It's been out for about a week now, so if you want to catch it on VMAX or any of the other premium screens around the place, I'd be very quick and get onto that as soon as possible.
I knew handing the review over to you was the right thing to do because you brought an insight and an energy to that review that we don't often see from you. We go from turtles to Beatles.
I was
going to
say, Simon, I didn't really bring enough of an insight. If you wanted insight, I could have talked about the introduction of characters who, yes, they had been in the original Ninja Turtles cartoon, but certainly realized largely through the comic books of the time. So characters like Leatherhead and Wingnut and, who else? Mondo Gecko. Good. They're all from the comics.
I know. That's great. I know. No, you brought enthusiasm. That's all we count on sometimes. Like I said, turtles to Beatles now. I review Blue Beetle.
Everything right now feels so out of reach.
You always land on your feet, bro. You're Jaime.
They don't get out much.
I just want to rap.
Jenny?
I just want to rap.
Garth, I bet your life, but do not open it.
You went in to get us jobs, and all you brought back was a hamburger?
Okay, I don't think it's a burger.
You haven't looked?
What the hell is that?
How did you get it to do that?
I think he likes me.
It's on your face! Get it off! Get it off!
Turtles, Beatles, what is this, Animal Planet? Okay, look, the new DC superhero film Blue Beetle is in cinemas at the moment. I am hoping that you will weigh in on this because DC's kind of your thing and the world of comic book movies and superheroes is very much you, as we established in the Ninja Turtles review there. Blue Beetle is the story of a young man. And what I found really interesting about this film, his name's Jaime Reyes, played by Zolo Maraduena, who returns home to his family south of the border in Mexico City, only to find that corporations are taking over the suburbs, the family house is in all sorts of dire straits, the business is collapsing, and a great many of the things that are impacting Latino culture in the US have impacted his family. And this movie leans very heavily into the Latino experience, the Mexican experience living in American culture. It initially does so with a great deal of humor. And then in one very key sequence in which armed raiders take on the family home, very familiar and very shocking images to people of Mexican heritage and Mexican immigrants in America. And I think that's the point of difference here with Blue Beetle. It is a film that, yes, it leans heavily into the superhero tropes and does so effectively, but not all that innovatively. But where it does find a bit of heart and a bit of energy is in the portrayal of the Mexican family. You've got the wonderful Elpidia Carrillo in there as Jaime's mother. I've followed her career ever since she was the sole female character in Arnold Schwarzenegger's Predator all those years ago. She's still as beautiful and as talented as ever. You've got George Lopez as the conspiracy-obsessed Uncle Rudy, and a terrific young actress in Belissa Escobedo as the sister of Jaime. Also in there is Bruna Marquezina, who plays Jenny Cord, the stepdaughter of Susan Sarandon's main villain of the Victoria Cord of the Giant Cord Empire. So there's big business treading on small immigrant dreams, and in the mix to fix all these wrongs is the Blue Beetle, who is Jaime's alter ego that comes about when the blue scarab is ingested by him, and he can and sets about it actually taps into his brain and reacts when he's being threatened, and which is a really interesting take on the whole superhero superpowers thing. So I came away from this, I quite enjoyed it, ran a bit long, and the superhero stuff was a bit rote, but the actual characterizations and the way it uses in Mexican culture is really interesting. So can you add any more insight into exactly the history of the Blue Beetle, Dan? Because, you know, I don't know that.
Look, I can. So I'm actually a really big fan of the Blue Beetle generally. So there's a couple of points of connection which I think probably link themselves to where this movie is and the sort of comics history on it. So the Blue Beetle has been a character that's been around since like the, I think, 1939, 1940, thereabouts. So yep. Like, in terms of comic book publishing history, like that's certainly been the long legacy of it. Like it's definitely one of the longest lasting sort of superhero character properties. But what's probably notable about it, and you'll feel this when you're sitting in the cinema watching the movie, there's a couple of incarnations of the Blue Beetle character. So the first one's a guy named, Dan Garrett, okay, who I'm unfamiliar with the Dan Garrett character. I think he was an archaeologist and found like a blue beetle scarab thing that gave him some sort of beetle powers. Probably, they're not exactly the same as the Blue Beetle in this film, but it's certainly linked to like that scarab, because I think that's what happens in the current version. It's like a little scarab totem type thing. Yeah,
exactly.
But the character I know of it is the character that came about in the 60s, okay, which this character's called Ted Kord, and he's referred to a fair bit in this live-action film. So
yes, yeah.
Keep he's going. Like the main Blue Beetle that most people who know Blue Beetle know, like that version of the character. Now, he's a character that's been part of the Justice League, but what's interesting about him is that he's a bit of a Batman-like character in that he doesn't have any superpowers. He just dresses up like a giant Blue Beetle. Okay? It is what it is. Basically, he's a wealthy tech guy. But the creation of that character, okay, or at least like the interpretation of the character, I don't think he existed as part of like the early sort of run of it, was created by Steve Ditko, who's one of the co-creators of Spider-Man. Yes. So when they came to phased Headcord out of the comics in the mid-2000s and introduced the Jaime character who we're seeing here in the new Blue Beetle film. A lot of the inspiration for this character came very much from Spider-Man. Okay, so they kind of turned him into a teenage superhero and gave him a very sort of Spider-Man outlook on the world, but gave him this Hispanic background and sort of changed things up that way a little bit.
Okay, well, that's all.
It's just kind of interesting thinking about like that Steve Ditko influence on the Blue Beetle character is sort of brought right back in full circle for the current incarnation. Because especially when I look at this live action film, the live action film looks very much like it's DC trying to do a Spider-Man movie.
Okay, that's an interesting, and I'm so glad you said all of that because that puts into perspective a lot of the backstory that is introduced in the film that I maybe would have benefited from if I knew of it. Legacy and family history, both on the side of the Jenny Cord character and Sarandon's Victoria Cord character, and on the Jaime Reyes side is really sort of central to the story in this and gives it a whole lot of oomph. And yes, it is. There are absolute nods to the development of Spider-Man and how it sort of plays into this story as well through the film. So I would suggest that you're probably going to really like this film because it does a bang-up job of making it look great on the big screen. And it does, by everything you've said there, seem to honor the history of the Blue Beetle development. So that's a bonus. That's good.
What's fascinating about this movie is that this was originally made for what was then HBO Max. So the idea was they were going to make some sort of lowish budget movies that were not quite at the scale of what you'd see at the cinema, but they'd focus it on some lesser known characters and like sort of half well known, but not really your Superman, Batman sort of level characters. And this would be the sort of thing driving subscriptions for HBO Max. But then the new ownership came in and they looked at some of the projects on the boil and I thought, well, why are we spending $80 million on a movie for streaming? That doesn't make a lot of economic sense. It probably would have made more sense if it was like a $20 to $30 million film, okay, as opposed to $80 million. So they looked at that, thought, well, could we maybe pump a bit more money into this and make it into a cinema release? Okay, so up the special effects, give another like set piece or two, and try to up that. So I'm going to be kind of curious watching this, thinking, well, this was originally made for streaming. Like, what have they done where they've Frankensteined it into being a bigger screen release? And if people have heard the furor around the Batgirl movie that got cancelled, that's because much like Blue Beetle, that was being produced for streaming. They looked at it and thought, well, look, we could put all this money into it, but like it's going to look not really quite at the standard where people won't be disappointed having spent money at the cinema going to see this. So they weren't comfortable releasing it. So thought, tax write-off, let's do that instead.
And yet, local publicity officials for the film through Universal Warner Brothers gave it a very low key, what they call a fan only screening here in Sydney, and only invited a handful of the very top tier critics. So I was there, and in Melbourne,
so top.
So I got a friend of a friend to get me in. And yet in Melbourne, they didn't invite any critics. They didn't have a critic screening for it. So they're not showing a whole lot of faith in it as a pumped up streaming release, you know, pumped up for cinema. Well, certainly not here in Australia anyway. I don't know what the expectations are at the US box office. But yeah, that's unfortunate because it actually plays better than the last handful of, other than the Spider-Verse one, plays better than the last few sort of superhero films that I've seen. So check it out, people, even if you're not a fan.
The bit of context you probably need to consider there is that, one, the film did not perform particularly well in the US, but two, the film, I think they were largely investing the money in it, not so much for global audiences as much as there's a belief that a lot of box office, so generally a lot of box office is driven by teenagers. Teenagers like 20 somethings, that's really who sort of tends to power a lot of things for that first sort of one or two opening weekend sort of carry throughs. So it's largely that, but also there's a really big Hispanic audience, which are still strong moviegoers. And so they were looking at this as an opportunity to talk to that audience really directly. And so I would imagine a lot of the money and consideration that went into taking this from being not a tax write-off, but instead something they're releasing in cinemas, was they thought, we've got an underserved audience who are very much there for the sort of product we're releasing. This should probably actually do gangbusters with them. They dropped that in cinemas.
US domestically.
And it did not. it did not perform very well at all in the US. Like, it did okay numbers. No one's like losing their jobs over it, but also it just didn't really deliver. So I'd assume that a lot of those sort of considerations went into whether or not they make a big deal about it internationally.
It's also in that gray area now where DC exists, and the new Aquaman film, the trailer of which dropped this morning as we record this as well, also exists in that it's the pre-Gunn era. Are they just sort of cleaning house before Gunn takes over and sort of reworks the whole DC universe, or are they going to somehow play in? Because this film finishes on an opener where they sort of gently introduce a character that's been central to the story but has been not in the film.
You can say Ted Kord. It's fine.
It's Ted Kord. And I'm assuming the Aquaman thing is going to be in the same sort of boat. So, yeah, the next, as we've mentioned a few times this year, the next sort of 12 months for DC is going to be a reshifting and refocusing, and how they work all these sundry characters into the James Gunn vision for the DC universe is
I just don't think they will. I think this is probably the last time you see this incarnation of Blue Beetle, unless they do something.
Do you really think they're just going to clean slate at all? The Gunn's just going to go in there and just reboot the whole lot?
Yeah.
Even Aquaman?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Look, tracking on the new Aquaman film isn't particularly that amazing.
Yeah.
Like, they're not expecting this to be a big success in the way the first one was.
We'll see. All right. Like I say, an interesting 12 months ahead. Because that's a huge property. They're not going to. I can't imagine them sort of kicking Jason Momoa out of the, taking his car parking spot.
Gone.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Let's move on. Let's go to something completely different. You watched a new TV series called The Levers.
I'll keep this brief, Jim.
Keep what brief?
Stop the swearing, the lateness, the stain.
I don't swear.
You swore at Jason.
He provoked me.
Why, what'd he say?
Good morning. What does he think he is, a fucking Disney princess?
Another mad, bad, and dangerous week at Westminster. See you next Sunday.
Are you a TV presenter?
Yeah.
Are you famous?
Kind of. People were looking.
Nobody was looking.
I'm Seamus O'Hanigan! There's nobody in Belfast know who I am!
Simon, I'm going to keep this one pretty brief, which isn't to say this isn't a good program, because it really quite is, just because it's a rom-com, and I don't know, there's a lot of angles really to go too deep into it.
Sure.
Largely what you've got here is a cast who, outside of supporting actor, I didn't really know them particularly that well. You've got Johnny Flynn, who plays this guy named Seamus. He's a political reporter based out of Britain. His origin story is that he came from Belfast, but he tries to forget like his sort of younger years. So clearly it wasn't something which was a good time for him. But he's been a commentator on various sort of political roundtable programs, and is a pretty big deal in terms of politics viewers. But outside of that, people don't really know him. And that's kind of one of the sort of comedic flexes that they keep on sort of making through this. So he's been sent back to Belfast to interview a couple of people for what will be the first episode of a show which is built around him. So it's a pretty big deal, and there's a lot of pressure on him. So he's back in Belfast, and when he's there, he's out on the street doing what seems to be a really terrible man on the street sort of introduction, interview type. It's like an interstitial he's shooting.
Natural.
Well, it's like an interstitial that he's shooting with the idea it's going to throw to like something in the studio, but it's really poorly written, like what he's saying on screen. I think sort of deliberately so, but yeah, it just seems like a terrible program. Anyway, he's there. He upsets some of the youths around who start chasing after him with, you know, bats and bricks and everything else. And so he's genuinely scared for his life. He's running through the laneways and ends up sort of climbing over a fence, where on the other side of that fence is a character played by Royson Gallagher, and she is a woman who's got some mental health issues, works in a supermarket, tells everyone just what she thinks of them without any real restraints at all. She has no boundaries as a character. She looks up at him, he looks down at her, and what makes the whole situation a bit awkward is that she's there against the fence because she's got a gun strapped to the bottom of her like chin, and she's about to commit suicide. Oh, this is a comedy, Simon. So anyway, he interrupts the suicide attempt, and then they kind of spend a night together as he doesn't want to leave the house because, you know, they're teenagers. And, you know, she's obviously in a bit of an emotionally vulnerable state.
Well, I would think he would want to stay there to help support her as well. There must be some of that played into it.
A little bit. But, you know, they don't really talk about the suicide. It's one of these things that's kind of awkward. But, you know, once the gun's put aside, let's not actively talk about it. But, like, it's...
How can we have the ultimate anti-meet cute, like the exact opposite of what a meet cute should be, I guess was the pitch there. So,
yeah.
Okay, fine.
All absolutely.
Right. Do go on.
And so the two of them spend like this night together and are people from entirely different worlds. He's a big fancy TV guy. She's just like a woman working in a supermarket and just living a very everyday human existence. Anyway, she has no idea who he is. And that becomes one of the sort of ongoing bits. There's a great moment in the second episode where the two of them are there in a hotel, I'll say debating something. But anyway, she says, we can do this if, he was concerned people would see them and he's in a relationship with another woman. So that's a bit of a complication in his life. And he was concerned that other people would see the two of them in this hotel together. And she looks around and says, nobody knows who you are. It doesn't really matter. And so there's this great sequence.
It's kind of the anti Notting Hill as well. There's got that element to it as well. Okay.
100%.
I like that.
And it's like him walking around like this sort of hotel, bar, restaurants, and just like doing all that he can to get like any attention at all. And he's just not getting a single bar of it. But like, it's little great moments like that where they're both very cognizant of who each other are and what their weaknesses are. And a lot of it plays around with the ego and suffering and just a real desire to no longer really be who you are and where you sort of find yourself in life. It's an interesting character study. It's a good rom-com. I don't know there's actually sort of some genuine chemistry between the two leads. Like, I just never really quite felt that heat. I'm sure other people are probably watching it feeling that that was there, but for me, I wasn't feeling that in the slightest.
I mean,
oh yeah, great looking couple.
And he's a handsome guy, yeah.
Yeah. Also in the cast is a woman that he's like a, you know, reasonably well-established relationship that he's in with a character called Frankie, played by Alice Eve, who you've certainly seen in a bunch of movies.
She was the it girl for a little while there, and her career kind of unraveled after the bra scene in that Star Trek movie. The internet sort of got banked up against her and what's his name, Abrams, for putting...
Well, I don't think people criticized her for it. I think it was just that this didn't need to be in the movie.
Yeah, it sort of filtered down to her. No, you're right. It wasn't her fault that happened, but it was a ill-judged moment in that film. And so I like her a lot. It's good to see her in this. I'm going to check this out. This looks sweet.
Yeah, no, it's really lovely. So this is a ITV comedy from the UK. You can find it here streaming on Binge. You know what I liked Alice Eve in? I mean, there's a couple of things. Starter for 10. Did you ever see that film? That was... what's his name?
McAvoy.
Yeah, James McAvoy.
Yeah, no, I know the film. No, I never did see it. But yeah, she had a run and she's still making movies. They're just not the big US ones that she was sort of destined to make. But yeah, no, I like her too. She's lovely.
Yeah, she's good in that. She's also in She's Out of My League, which is that good Jay Baruchel film. Yeah, good stuff. Okay. Simon, what are we talking about next?
All right, let's go to Venice for A Haunting in Venice.
Hercule Poirot, I've found something. I've looked at it from every which way. I am the smartest person I ever met, and I can't figure it out, so I came to the second.
You are up to something, my friend.
I've seen a million of these so-called psychics, each one a fake.
I do not believe in psychics.
Come with me to a seance. Spot the con, I can't.
A couple of weeks ago, I got an email invite to the screening for this, and I looked at the name of the film because I was unfamiliar with the book that it's based on, and I just assumed it was some sort of fairly low-rent, cheap ghost story, and so I dismissed it entirely. So when I hear a lot of commentary at the moment about how box office tracking isn't particularly high on this movie, I do wonder if the title of this movie shouldn't necessarily just be A Haunting in Venice, but maybe Agatha Christie's A Haunting in Venice. I think we'd probably get people along to it.
That's an interesting point of view because it's definitely geared towards, and I've been reading a lot of coverage of this lately, how it's geared towards that more, obviously the more mature moviegoer, and Agatha Christie's A Haunting in Venice would also get people to ask, well, I don't remember the Agatha Christie book A Haunting in Venice. It was actually called Halloween Party, and it's been changed for this film.
Well, then, terrible name.
I mean, and it's given them the option to really sort of lean into the supernatural, or are they elements in the trailer for this? And it's been given a big sort of blustery kind of trailer. So having seen the film, that kind of plays out. Let me just backtrack a little bit here. It's directed by Kenneth Branagh, who's found a nice little cash cow for himself playing Hercule Poirot with a borderline hilarious accent in three films to date, the first one of which, Murder on the Orient Express, I really liked. Second one, Death on the Nile, was a bit of a cheapie and looked kind of tinny and I didn't really like. But with A Haunting in Venice, he's working with producer Ridley Scott, and that has afforded him a much bigger budget, I would suggest, than has been at his disposal in the past. And he's created this beautiful looking film, not just because it's Venice, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world, but because he's able to cast people like Tina Fey, Michelle Yeoh, Jamie Dornan in there, a really, really solid cast. Who's the actress I'm trying to think of who's Kelly Riley, who's opposite Costner in Yellowstone? She's in there as well. So you've got this terrific cast, all looking absolutely stunning, all set amongst this villa, not really a villa, I guess you could say, like an old cathedral-type building, an old mansion in Venice where there has been a death of a young girl, and Branagh, as Poirot, has been called in to crack the case to establish if Michelle Yeoh is in fact a legitimate medium and if what she has done is revealed some shenanigans behind the scene that lead to the exposing of the killer as it really was. It's engaging. It's very good. It's thoroughly entertaining. It's great to watch these stars go through their big movie moments. And Branagh, who I can sort of, I know he's an enormous talent and has been for many, many years, but he's kind of hammy and can really lean into the scenery and have a bit of a nibble when he wants to. In this one, he does less of that, and he, as a director, he's able to capture these really big sort of gothic moments. He made a terrific thriller with Emma Thompson way back when called Dead Again, and this is the closest any of his Agatha Christie films have come to sort of recapturing that, the energy and the skill that he brought to the thriller Dead Again. So I don't think by the third film his version of Poirot or the fact that it's Agatha Christie is going to win over any new viewers. And it's also lovely to see Tina Fey back on the screen. She has a lot of fun in this part. But I must admit, I thought this was a pretty terrific bit of entertainment.
Yeah, look, I'll check it out on streaming. I like the idea of the supporting cast. I wasn't that big a fan of the first film in the series, and I especially didn't care for Branagh's performance in it. But look, I like the idea of this.
Yeah. Okay. Haunting in Venice. Keen to see. I'm not sure if it has released in the US as yet, but it's
this weekend.
It's sort of tracking of this weekend. All right. Well, let's see how it goes. Because I think the other two, well, Death on the Nile wasn't, it was delayed nonstop through COVID and through, because it had Army Hammer attached to it. They had to try and sort of rework the marketing campaign so nobody knew he was in it by the time they'd bought their tickets. But I remember Murder on the Orient Express was a big hit and was a beautiful-looking film, so hopefully this will lean more towards that as a cinema release. A Haunting in Venice is in cinemas as we speak.
Yeah, they should have played up the Army Hammer part and just not run away from it. Just try to appeal to that foodie crowd.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Too soon.
Simon, I believe this brings us to the intermission.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
You so pleased me when you chose to go with our celebration of the X-Files at 30. Hey, I'm treading all over your intro. This was your idea. So please kick us off with what I'm really looking forward to as an intermission.
I mean, that's pretty much the entire thing. The X-Files turned 30. So last weekend, it was the 30th anniversary of the program. So 10th of September 1993, debuted in the US. We didn't get it here in Australia until the following February. So it was a couple of months in before X-Files Mania started.
Remember those days when you'd see it on the cover of newspaper, on cover of magazines, remember what they were? And we had to wait a few months to get it out here, help build the buzz. But, I mean, by the time it hit there was a real buzz about it.
Look, so if you want to use this as a bit of a case study in trying to understand the psychology of one Dan Barrett, this actually came along at a really interesting point in my life where I was a huge X-Files fan. So from that first season onwards, I was gaga for it. Ruled my life. But that also coincided with my family moved states. And so the first sort of week or two of me living in the new home of Brisbane, the X-Files began. And so that's where I first saw it. So it kind of coincided with my entire life being upheaved. Is that a word? Upheaved. So I kind of, if I'm going to play armchair psychologist, I think maybe I latched onto this show in a bigger way than I otherwise would have, because it was creating some stability and something that was a bit more, you know, just finding a grounding
in my new location. Yeah, that's a reasonable thing to assume.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just a thought that I've been having this last week, because just, you know, it's memories of sitting.
Why it means so much. Yeah, exactly. And, well, and I would say that for me, I was at a, I mean, I was, what is it, late, what are we saying?
So 94 it debuted here.
Okay. All right. So I'm
35.
Shut up. No, I'm not. How old am I in 94? I'm not getting too far away from that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So this was a huge deal for me. It became central. I was in my late 20s. So it was coming to mid 20s. I was coming to this became appointment television for me. This was the biggest thing that had come along. I'd been obsessed with UFOs and monsters and all these sort of things my whole life. So to have a show that is spoken of in the same breath as The Twilight Zone and it being a modern equivalent of Night Stalker and Twilight Zone and those sort of things, it was a huge deal. And then when the two glamours get out in front of it, Gillian Anderson and David Duchovny, and they've got this electric energy that you really found yourself tuning in for every week, that was a big deal. And I don't know if in this day and age we can convey to some of the kids who are listening, hey, kids, just how dominant they were in pop culture history. There was no fragmentation in this sort of, in these pre-internet times. If you walked into a newsagent, the first 15 or 20 or so magazine covers you would see at any given time would have had the David Duchovny and or Gillian Anderson in some kind of pose, whether it was Rolling Stone, they were on the cover of Time magazine, they were on all the big sort of not just pop culture magazines, they were on the cover of news magazines as well. And so it was an enormous pop culture moment in and it also was right at the start of when the Fox network were just sort of kicking things off. And who'll ever forget that hilarious moment in The Simpsons when they have to try to fill a few segments on the Fox schedule and they show that the whiteboard and it's got all these empty squares except for The Simpsons and Melrose Place and The X-Files. It's one of my favorite jokes on The Simpsons. Anyway, so yeah, The X-Files was a huge, huge deal, and 30 years just stuns me that it's gone that fast. But yeah, great stuff.
So The X-Files as a series comes along at the exact right time for where the world was at. So ordinarily a show like this wouldn't really have had the cultural resonance that it did. But where I think the show found the success was a couple of things. One, I think the two leads of the show, smoking hot, okay?
Smoking hot.
You know, you can't get past that. So you got two really appealing leads in her. And also Gillian Anderson, not the kind of person that you usually expect to see leading a show like this. You know, she was like a cute little redhead lady. Usually someone like this is cast as like a tall, buxom brunette. Blonde lady was usually the way this sort of thing goes.
Sure.
And like she's talked a lot about how she was cast in this sort of very much against the type for what's did. You know, really expect to find there. So you've got like these two
and
leads.
Chris Carter fought for that as well. Chris Carter like recognized the chemistry between them and really fought to have her involved.
Supposedly. I mean, I'd also sort of contend that Chris Carter didn't have a huge amount of power, and this was a show that didn't have a huge amount of expectation behind it either. So I don't know how much fighting he really had to do, or if they're just kind of like, yeah, okay, whatever, we don't care. I feel that's probably more the case. But anyway, this is certainly a show that nobody expected to succeed by any means. It was dumped on a Friday night at 9 p.m. Like this is not like a premium TV show expectation on it. So anyway, this show came along, and it comes along in the early 90s where this is the rebellion against the 80s. So the greed is good, the sort of strong corporates, big government era of Reaganomics and whatnot. It comes at a time mm-hmm. where it's just after the Gulf War took place. So it's kind of in a sort of perfect place. And I'm sure the show itself tapped into a lot of this because it was kind of in the like mood of the moment. But you've got this sort of anti-corporate thing, anti-government, anti-establishment sort of world. And so the series is about two FBI agents who are there questioning everything that you expect to be true. So they're questioning the government.
Questioning authority.
They're questioning yeah. the powers of authority around. There's the belief that there's stuff going on that no one's really being told about. So you've got all of that kind of bubbling away within it. You've also got, it's the like the early era of the internet is starting to bubble along at this point. So yep. like 94, 95 is where you start getting people onto Usenet, and you've got like that aspect of internet culture starting to permeate its way through. And it's one of the first shows the internet really just properly embraced.
I would also say that if you go the other way, this at this point in time, certainly people of my age, I guess, maybe a little older, were looking at the new millennium coming about, and we were all terrified in bunny ears about what this new dawn of the millennium was going to represent to mankind. If you look back at a lot of what Hollywood was doing at that point in time, and not just in The X-Files, but in some of the big cinema releases at that time, there was this more soulful kind of look to the future. Are we going to make it better? Are we going to make it worse? Are all the things that we thought were true going to change with the new millennium coming around? So you're absolutely right. X-Files dropped right at a time when coming off the 80s and early 90s, when we were really starting to rev up the anti-government and the anti-authoritarian sort of look at life, we were also facing an uncertain future. And this X-Files sort of played into that sense of what's next.
Yeah. And look, the same sort of vibes can be felt through the music of that early 90s period. So this is coming up at a time on TV at the same time that grunge music was starting to really become like the dominant sort of music sort of within the sort of alt scene of the US. And so you start looking at the culture sort of surrounding that, and you've got these sort of unusual cultural figures cropping up, like the Jim Rose Sideshow Circus. Is that the name of the circus? The Jim Rose Circus.
In the episode Humbug, yeah.
Coming back. And yeah, so I mean, they actually factor into a season two episode of the show called Humbug. But like you've got these guys, and so like the idea of sort of freak shows and aliens and monsters and government conspiracies and everything else, like it was just this melting pot of everything the show just like lent into from the first couple of episodes just really reverberated through what was happening culturally at the time. So it was just absolute right show at the right place.
Which gave rise to, and in hindsight, it's proven to be one of the most potent sort of taglines for a series ever is "I want to believe." That's it became so synonymous with the show and so synonymous with how everyone engaged with the show. In hindsight, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, and the other catchphrase obviously being "the truth is out there." So again, tapping into that idea that we're just not being told everything. But anyway, a couple of quick questions I thought we'd throw out there for this intermission. So
sure.
X-Files was a cultural phenomenon at the time, okay? Which means that when you've got a big successful show, there's a lot of knockoffs that came out just in the years that followed. So I would say from late 94 through to like the very, like say 98, there were so many paranormal, supernatural TV shows on the air at the time.
Sure.
Are there any of those that resonate with you? Is there things that you sort of think back fondly of from these many shows that popped up?
The only one that sticks with me is Lance Henriksen's Millennium, which was a very dark follow-up from the Chris Carter stable. I remember watching that and thinking this is exactly in the speaks to the really darkest moments in the X-Files. So that was one that has really stayed with me. I'm sure you've got a few there yourself, but that's probably the key of them. The others I all sort of recognized as being very much in the wake of X-Files and trying to cash in on the X-Files special brand of television and huge success. So I would say Millennium for me is the pick of them.
Yeah, look, I mean, Millennium, I think, sort of holds pretty well in my memory as well. So Millennium is actually three different programs. So there was the first season, which Chris Carter ran, which was very much a guy I could kind of see in the minds of serial killers. And If you even look at the early sort of visual style of the X-Files, a lot of it's modeled after Silence of the Lambs, even from like the title cards of how that's displayed on the screen for the X-Files. So that was clearly in his mind when Millennium came about. So that first season, heavy on the serial killers. Second season starts delving into religious cults and consideration of, maybe religious conspiracy might be the way to consider it. And then the third season of that was kind of made more of a cop show than the previous two incarnations of the show. And it was always a show that was looking for new direction because it never quite launched the success that the X-Files had at the time. So no. I think Chris Carter may have lost interest in it pretty quickly because it wasn't quite firing on all cylinders. So there's that. Other shows, there's a show called Profiler, which starred Ali Walker, I think the actor's name is.
Yes, it did. Yeah, I remember
Julian McMahon was in that one as well, I think. That one was pretty good. There's a lot of talk that show was in development and Chris Carter came across the development of that and stole a number of elements from that show and put that into Millennium as that's going on. So there's definitely some backroom tension regarding those two shows. But Profiler did launch and I thought that was a pretty good program. I also like there was another show that was from some of the stronger writers from the X-Files, Glenn Morgan and James Wong, who did the show called Space Above and Beyond. The pilot of that one was actually filmed on the Gold Coast, but the rest of it filmed in the US. And a lot of the actors from that show ended up appearing in the X-Files as like the next couple of years sort of went on. But that was always a pretty nifty program as well. I was a big fan of that. But yeah, there was Strange World, I think might have been one of them, with D.B. Sweeney in it. Like that wasn't too bad.
Okay.
But yeah, it seemed like every night there was about four or five different supernatural things that cropped up. And the one that I always kind of remember is something which... Yeah. Did you ever remember Kindred the Embraced?
No, I don't remember that one.
So this was a vampire show from Aaron Spelling. Okay. I'm pretty sure Brian Thompson, who's like the big beefy sort of Schwarzenegger looking guy that starts cropping up in X-Files. I'm pretty sure he was in that. He's also in one of your favorite films, Simon, Midnight.
What's it called? I had the t-shirt on yesterday. Miracle Mile.
Miracle Mile.
He's the helicopter pilot. Yes.
Yeah, he does. He's great. But yeah, Kindred the Embraced. But if people want to understand how big the X-Files was at the time, there was a Baywatch spin-off series called Baywatch Nights. And the first season of that program was David Hasselhoff and the guy that's like the sort of chunky African-American guy that used to also be providing the surf life-saving sort of bona fides on the program. No one ever remembers that guy. But the two of them ended up going off to run this nightclub called Baywatch Nights. And so every week, like some, you know, person would be in trouble. And so in a Magnum PI sort of style way, David Hasselhoff as Mitch Buchanan, him and the other guy would go and solve the mystery of the week through the detective agency. They were also running through this nightclub. So anyway, they got that. The show stank, obviously. But the second season, they retooled it. So it wasn't them helping just everyday people. Every week, Mitch Buchanan from Baywatch would get caught up in some sort of supernatural event that took place. And I do remember an episode with David Hasselhoff as Mitch Buchanan from Baywatch going to an alternate dimension, like an alternate reality where vampires were the dominant people on the planet. Fantastic.
Clearly I've got to watch this. Which brings us to... we should weigh up what are our fave episodes of the X-Files. We've mentioned Humbug, which is certainly up there as one of my favorite episodes, and whether the Monster of the Week episodes are as well remembered or as fondly remembered as those mythology arcs, the whole sort of extraterrestrial alien,
the conspiracy stuff,
Let me just weigh in on a couple of the Monster of the Week episodes, which are my favorites. I can remember the day and date where I saw season one, episode five, The Jersey Devil. That was one of the very early episodes where you realized, wow, they're going to do some really interesting things with, sort of great old folklore monsters and things like Bigfoots and stuff like that. So I love The Jersey Devil. I decided to introduce my in-laws at the time to the X-Files the very same time that an episode called Home came on, season four, episode two. We all decided to settle in for the story of what would become the story of a hillbilly family, terribly malformed that starts with some kids playing baseball in a paddock, and a dead baby comes up through the ground with blood all over it, and it's horrible. It is still considered one of the most shocking hours of television that has ever come down the pipe, and it still holds up as a really terrifying bit of television. The other one I love, and I noticed it's got Titus Welliver in it, your man, is a season one, episode 20. Remember there were 20 episodes in a season of television called Darkness Falls, where they all go out into the woods and the little fluorescent bugs are encasing people in a spidery web. And that is one of my favorite episodes as well. I also love how they used to have a lot of humor in their episodes, and War of the Caprophages, season 3, episode 12, which was the one with the little metallic cockroaches everywhere, I thought was an absolute blast as well. So they're some of my favorite Monster of the Week episodes.
So I did a rewatch of the show a couple of years ago, so maybe like 7 years ago, thereabouts. So it's been a while now. I've actually been thinking about doing a rewatch. I have been watching a couple of the early episodes again this last week.
Yep.
The episode you're talking about, Darkness Falls, I remember not liking that very much when I was originally watching the program, both when it first aired as well as the next couple of years where I spent rewatching every episode on VHS just routinely. I remember not liking that episode, but like recently, like when I did watch it 7 years ago, like that one actually really stood out as being much better than I really appreciated. The cockroach episode, the robot cockroach episode, I actually think played entirely the opposite direction. I don't think that holds up very well at all. I think it's just kind of a silly, terrible episode of the show. But some of the comedy episodes do actually play pretty well. So the two best ones being Jose Chung's From Outer Space, which is towards the end of the third season. And that one is a sort of look at memory and the way that memory can be suggestible. Great guest appearance in that one by Alex Trebek, playing a man in black. Yep. Anyway, that episode is really wacky and strange and deeply fascinating. But then early that season as well, you've got the episode Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose, which has the Emmy Award winning appearance by, what's his name?
Peter Boyle.
Frankenstein's monster.
Peter Boyle.
Yeah, Peter Boyle. Also probably better remembered these days, the dad from Everyone Loves Raymond.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, those are favorites, but yeah.
When you mentioned worst episode there, for me, the standalone storylines jumped the shark with season 7, episode 13, First Person Shooter. That was where there's a murder inside this virtual reality game, and it led Scully to do it. It led to Scully and Mulder to battle this digital character inside this virtual reality world. And I thought, okay, they're both trying to be ultra contemporary and ultra modern by looking at the world of virtual reality, but there is so much about that they got wrong. I remember I've watched that a few times over the years, and it continues to irk me as a time when they were really just trying to stay contemporary and stay modern, but also as them just pushing too hard to make something relevant, and it didn't work in that regard. Has the mythology episodes held up for you? Things like EBE and Anasazi and Tunguska, they're some of my favorite episodes from the day, but now knowing how that whole narrative arc plays out, I'm not sure as I'd be as sort of super keen to jump back into those as I would be to the Monster of the Week episodes.
So look, I try not to ever think about it too much in terms of how that sort of petered out a little bit as the series went on. But also, I would say the series petered out. As big a fan as I was, there are large chunks of the back end of the series that I never saw. Like, I don't think I've seen much.
Totally agree.
Yeah, I haven't seen like a lot of season 8 and a lot of season 9. Yeah,
I'm the same. Season 9 and 10, I didn't sort of, season 8 and 9, I didn't weigh in on too much. And there's still episodes with Robert Patrick and Annabeth Gish, both who I love as actors and liked what they were doing. But all that their casting pointed out to me was how important it was to see Duchovny and Anderson doing their stuff on screen together, and how that was such an integral part of what we loved, what everybody loved about the show, this birth of these two sort of big stars that came out of the television world. So,
But to answer your question, Simon, the mythology episodes, the general conversation around the program is that the Monster of the Week episodes still hold up really well, and the mythology episodes not so much. And there's definitely an element of that being right, but I kind of think that what gets forgotten in trying to frame that as a conversation is that a big reason why the show took off to begin with was because of those mythology episodes. As I said at the beginning, the reason the show really succeeded wasn't because of Monster of the Week episodes. If the show was just that, it never would have become the success that it was. It just wouldn't have.
No, exactly.
It'd be something that lasted for one, maybe two seasons, and then be fondly remembered by people in a way that folks still talk about Kolchak the Night Stalker. Okay, and like these days, people only talk about that show in relation to the X-Files and whatnot. Like, it's just, it's not well remembered. And the X-Files would have been one of those shows. But because it's tapped into the zeitgeist of the moment through those mythology eps, like, that's really just where the show popped and sizzled, and everyone just really just embraced it quite heavily. And when I watched the episodes back, certainly the Monster of the Week ones are the ones that I probably find a bit more engaging and certainly a bit more watchable and just, you know, I'm just going to drop in and watch an episode this week. But I do find that when I'm watching like one of the good mythology episodes, like, it still hits pretty well. You mentioned EBE, which is a episode from midway through that first season. Like, that one to me is definitely one of the absolute standouts. And there's some great moments like throughout the series. So season two ends on this.
Still one of my favorite episodes. I remember having the VHS of Tunguska and just watching that over and over. That was a great show.
Yeah.
Because
they stepped up the cinematography at that era of the show as well, Simon. So when you were watching that, it looked visually just lush in a way that most TV shows just weren't on the TV at the time. Like, it was an incredible looking program. And from that cinematography standpoint, where the show lost me a little bit wasn't actually so much in terms of anything they were doing story-wise or narrative. It was actually in the production shift from Vancouver to Los Angeles. There was something about the change in light and just the general sort of demeanor of the show, which just kind of shifted when it went from being something shot in a different country out in a forest to suddenly being shot, like, you know, just a few minutes drive from Duchovny and Anderson's homes.
Let's weigh in very quickly on the list of guest stars who made an... I went through this and I finally just had to sort of pull away because there were so many involved. We've mentioned Peter Baldwin in the Emmy for his performance. We've mentioned Titus Welliver. Throw in there Bradley Whitford. Throw in there Octavia Spencer. Lily Tomlin. One of our favourites, Shawnee Smith. Gary Shandling. Tobin Bell from the Saw movies we've mentioned. Minnie Driver. Joel McHale. Jodie Foster, but only her voice. She played the voice of the tattoo in the episode Never Again. Both sides of the Breaking Bad partnership. Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul both made appearances. Felicity Huffman in there. Jack Black. Lucy Liu. The list goes on. Shia LaBeouf. We're all sort of had guest roles in across the first five or six seasons of the X-Files. It was the place to be seen. Danny Trejo was in there. Candyman's Tony Todd. Mr. Peterman, John O'Hurley made an episode appearance in an episode. Ed Asner. So this was a place to be seen for a long time. Getting a gig on as a guest on the X-Files was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it was certainly a place where, I mean, largely, if you're a Canadian actor, at some point you've done a stint on the X-Files. They did many episodes and filmed so much in Canada that, you know, there's a number of actors who've played multiple roles on that show over the years as well.
The movies. Weigh me in on the movies. Are you a fan? Have you gone back?
Look, I saw the first film in the cinema a whole bunch of times because it was that peak sort of enthusiasm for me. Film, like, it's got elements that I quite liked. I think it's really nicely shot in terms of the cinematography, maybe not so much the direction at times. I don't know. I don't know that film necessarily holds up particularly well as a movie. The second film, I thought the idea of breaking it away to become more of a Monster of the Week sort of one-off story was definitely the right way to go with it. But ultimately, it just wasn't that good a film. That was the one with Billy Connolly in it.
Yeah, I've gone... I kind of agree with you. The first one was sort of the big, seeing him on the big screen and seeing Anderson and Duchovny up there doing their goo-goo eyes at each other was great, and I loved it, and I saw it half a dozen times at the movies. The second one I saw once at the movies and then a few times more on VHS and on television, and it actually holds up as a really sort of terrific piece of cinema. Like, it's got a dark heart to it. It's got Billy Connolly giving a very against type performance. I think the second one is probably a stronger piece of storytelling than the first film and works really well as a standalone. I might go back and watch it again because it's got some good stuff in there.
Look, I might revisit it because I remember not liking it at all in the cinema, but, you know, I've certainly have seen it once, so who knows. What did you think of the revival?
It had some great moments that harkened back to the original sort of energy of the first few seasons of the X-Files. I remember the marketing going in it, into it led us to believe it was going to be a series of like it was a standalone story. It was going to begin and end as part of the revival episodes. It didn't do that. It left very open-ended, which kind of gave me the poops. I don't think they had enough really interesting to say in those episodes. And it seemed like they were trying to you know, restart some of the chemistry and some of the storylines that had petered out by the end of the original series.
Yeah, I think there's actually some like stellar episodes in there, but they were far and few between.
Yeah, totally agree. The X-Files Albuquerque, they're doing an animated spin-off.
No, they're not.
Two guys called Rocky Russo and,
Simon, that's not happening anymore.
Not happening? That's closed down because that was sort of spoken of at one point. Okay. No. But earlier this year on a podcast, Chris Carter said that Ryan Coogler, who did Creed and the Wakanda films, the Black Panther films, they're going to remount the X-Files with a diverse cast. That's what Chris Carter told her on the Coast with the Gloria Makarenko podcast.
Simon, if that was happening, you'd have heard more about it than Chris Carter's hawking on a very out-of-the-way radio program.
It's a big name to drop with Ryan Coogler. If he sort of attaches himself to an X-Files reboot, who knows?
Simon, if that was happening, it would have happened by now. You'd have heard about it.
Happy birthday, X-Files. It's been fun. Thank you for all the good years. All right, what's up next?
Okay, very quickly, what else have you been watching? The answer for me is a whole bunch of the X-Files. Also, tonight, as we record this, Simon, I'm going off to watch The Paper, the 1993 Ron Howard movie with Michael Keaton.
Wow. God, that's a forgotten thing as well.
Yeah, so look, I really love that film. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, it's playing on the Goma Cinematheque tonight, and it's part of a John Seal retrospective program that's playing.
The great John Seal. Do you know what else is in the mix?
I mean, I know Gorillaz and the Mist is up there. What else? Yeah. American President's playing, because I'm seeing that one next week sometime.
Wow.
Beautiful. Yeah. There's a whole bunch of things, but if you're in Brisbane, check out the Goma Cinematheque website, and you can see the whole program there. I think that John Seal was like appearing at a panel. I don't know if it's in person or if it's a pre-recorded like live stream thing or something. But anyway, if you're interested, that might be worth checking out.
And on your say-so, I decided to do a bit of a deep dive into Pluto TV, specifically the Twilight Zone channel. Speaking of forebearers for the X-Files, oh my God, that is such a great series. I just dropped into one and before you know it, I was six episodes in. To think that this was on television 60 years ago and it was dealing with things like gambling addiction and suicides and PTSD and all within this sort of this genre of storytelling, The Twilight Zone, which I must admit I loved growing up but haven't sat down and watched for many years. I was just totally hooked and didn't mind the fast channel ad drop-in format either. I thought I was totally fine with it. So I'm settling in for a weekend watching a whole bunch more of Twilight Zone.
Yeah, a mate of mine, also on Pluto TV, has just started watching a whole bunch of the old Mission Impossible TV show from the mid-60s.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Cool. All right. This day in history. You ready for this?
Okay, hit me.
September 17, 1967, which rock group, I know you love your 60s rock music, make their first and only appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show when they refuse to change song lyrics considered offensive? Name the rock group.
I'm not sure. I feel this is one of these trivia questions where you're like, wait, someone found like that band offensive and I can't work out who it would be. I'm just going to say like the Monkees. I'm not sure.
Light My Fire by The Doors, Jim Morrison refused to change the lyric Girl, We Couldn't Get Much Higher. The producers thought the word higher was a bit too inappropriate for a family show, and Morrison said, we're not changing a word. So there you go. That's pretty cool. Good on you, Jim Morrison, for standing up to censorship. September 18, 1951, which sci-fi classic premieres on this day, introducing the iconic phrase, Klaatu Barada Nictu?
Now, I've never seen this, but I'm pretty sure we're talking about The Day the Earth Stood Still.
It was The Day the Earth Stood Still, directed by Robert Wise, who would go on to do The Sound of Music.
Stop. Oh, really?
Yeah, that's true. He was a big deal. September 22, 19...
Star Trek The Motion Picture?
And it's also Star Trek The Motion Picture. That's right, sir. And The Andromeda Strain, which was another classic sci-fi film. September 22, 1976, Charlie's Angels debuts, starring which three actresses?
Okay, you got your Farrah Fawcett.
The original Charlie Angels. Got your Farrah Fawcett before she was
amazing. You got your Farrah Fawcett. You've got your Kate Jackson.
Nice.
You've got your... Oh, gosh, what's her name?
See, this tested me too. I couldn't get Kate Jackson. This tested me a bit. I got the other one.
Oh, gosh. I could usually say Jacqueline Smith.
Nicely done, my friend. There you go. That's the end of the In History session.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
Hey, what do these birthday people have in common? September 18, 1975, Jason Sudeikis. September 23, 1959, Jason Alexander. Got the Jasons covered. September 24, 1948, the late, great Phil Hartman. And September 24, 1936, Jim Henson. What could these four gentlemen all have in common?
Okay. Now, I don't think that... I don't think Jim Henson did a stint in a improv comedy group in Amsterdam, so we can probably rule that out.
What? I can't be sure of that, but that's not the answer.
Only one of them was murdered by his wife.
All right. God, jeez, keep it light. They all made a buck doing this. Let me put it that way. That's
Look,
on the Facebook page.
Here's the thing. So I don't know for sure, but like when I think about Jason Alexander, the things that come to mind for him are obviously you've got your Seinfeld, you've got your show where he was there with Theo from Cosby Show. Can't think of the name of it. You've got your Pretty Woman. You've got your North, which he appeared in with Julie Dreyfus.
That was a high point from the cinema. Yep.
Okay. But I also think about the fact he was in that McDonald's ad where he was singing and dancing. Okay. And I don't know this for sure, but I kind of feel that maybe all four of them may have been like pitchmen in TV ads, singing and dancing, maybe.
You are very close. In fact, I'm going to give it to you this week. Yes, they have all appeared in McDonald's commercials. Jason Sudeikis.
Yeah?
Yeah, just this year, Jason Sudeikis did the Want to Go to McDonald's ad in his sort of pseudo Ted Lasso character. On September, Jason Alexander in 1985 did the now infamous new McDLT ad for McDonald's.
Yeah.
Phil Hartman did this hilarious, I'm Huge McAttack, saying Huge Mac Attack. He did a McDonald's ad with Victoria Jackson, his co-star in Saturday Night Live back in 1996. And Jim Henson has done a number of ads with McDonald's using his characters, the Muppets or Fraggle Rock or Dinosaurs, a lot of Happy Meal tie-ins there. So they've all done ads for McDonald's.
Well, I was thinking about, Jim Henson was the one that really sort of threw me when I was going to talk about the idea of maybe McDonald's, because I could kind of picture maybe Phil Hartman doing a Macca's ad, and I thought maybe Jason Sudeikis could have done one early in his career, but apparently just recently cashed out. But Jim Henson was I was thinking that a lot of the characters from the McHappy land, is that what they call them? Your cheese burglars and your grimaces and your Mayor McCheeses and whatnot.
Yep.
Like they were created by, what's it called? Like the HR Puff and Stuff guys.
Sid and Marty Krofft.
Yeah, Sid and Marty Krofft. Like they were designed by them. And so I couldn't position in my mind the idea of Jim Henson doing stuff with them when at that same time period they would have been working with Sid and Marty Krofft.
Total tie-ins. Total just Muppet, Fraggle Rock, Dinosaurs tie-in. So there you go.
Okay.
And if you go to the Facebook page, our Facebook page, I have got clips for all of those ads. You wait till you see the Phil Hartman one. It's hilarious. And I'll put those up underneath the birthday quiz post that I've already got up there. So there you go. That was a hard one. That took me ages. I'm in this very lean period with birthdays at the moment where there's not a lot of big stars and I'm kind of bouncing all over the place to try to find connections. So that one just settled on it. So there you go. I think we're done.
Okay, I think we are done. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett. You can find me on, the internet, just generally around the place or out on the streets.
So you were doing your thing with your Always Be Watching.
And yeah, I was going to say, check out alwaysbewatching.com. You can find the latest news in TV streaming and other streaming TV. Also, I've got a newsletter called Always Be Streaming, which drops on a Friday. It's a special bonus edition of the Always Be Watching email for our supporters. And if you're watching the ITV breakfast show in the next couple of days, you may see me there as well.
That's interesting. It's really the best thing in my inbox at the moment, your newsletters. I do enjoy reading them. That and the update from my Bob Guccione forum group. Screen Watching, you can find at Screen Watching Podcast on Facebook. On the X platform, we're at Screen _ Watching. On YouTube, we're at Screen Watching. Do go there to see the interview with the great Johan Gabrielsson. He did some amazing work. And you can email us with all your complaints about Dan's very obvious right-wing bent. screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. Over on Screen Space, that's my little page where I tend to just reprint press releases, screen-space.net.
Okay, folks, this has been hour 30 now of the podcast, so thank you very much for listening.